Hey folks, it's Jared. Today I'm welcoming back the first guest that I ever had on when we relaunched Sea Control, Captain Bill Shafley, and we're going to discuss his thoughts on restructuring the Desron staff. The episode was edited and produced by Jonathan Selling. I'd like to pause here to highlight our local chapters, whether you're in South Korea, Egypt, Singapore, France, New York, India, or the Caribbean. Chances are there's a SimSec local chapter near you. You can find a full listing of our chapters and contact information on the website at simsec.org, so if you're interested, please reach out. Finally, I want to take the opportunity to recommend our partners in the SimSec podcast network, The Bilge Pumps. You can find Alex, Jamie, Drac, and a pile of Iron Brew bottles wherever you download your podcasts. And with that, Kimber's Men.
You're listening to Sea Control, hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security.
Aloha, shipmates, and welcome back aboard Sea Control. My guest today is one of the originals from when we restarted the podcast back in January 2020, Captain Bill Shafley. Sir, welcome back. Could you tell the listeners again about your background, please?
Yeah, sure. Career surface warfare officer. I've commanded at the 05 level and most recently as the Commodore Desron 26, I guess, as I look at it. It's not so recent anymore. I think I've been out of command now for a couple years. I'm a graduate of the Advanced Strategy Program at the War College and wrapping up my almost 30 years of active duty here coming next spring. So I'm excited to move on to other things and see what other kinds of cool issues that I can tackle. So, I'm really glad to be here again with you today, Jared.
Well, thank you again for coming on. We're going to be discussing your article, A New Desron Staff Beyond the Composite Warfare Commander Concept, which you published with us at SimSec back on August 18, 2022. There will be a link in the show notes. As a reminder to the listeners, all opinions are our own and not reflective of any institution with which we might be otherwise associated. But sir, we'll start with you start out discussing the Cold War, the construction of carrier battle groups. How were the battle groups of the Cold War actually put together?
Well, I think if I were to characterize them, I would say that they're not much different than the way that you would conceive of them today, with the exception of a couple of big factors. One was just the sheer amount of stuff that was in a carrier battle group. And two was probably, I would say, the diversity of the platforms available in that particular in that particular mix set. And no surprise, what a carrier strike group of today is organized and what comprises it and how it's employed. You're routinely steaming around with 3 to 4, at least in the training phase of that whole thing. But, battle groups back then in the 600 ship Navy, double that, sometimes triple that. I've heard from some gray beards that you'd be steaming around with 12 ships at a battle group. And then I think the other thing, the big difference is there was just so many different types of ships, right? Perry classes, Knox classes, Spruance classes. So, I think you had a far bigger diversity of a platform then as well. But the one thing that I think it was pretty constant was this notion of the composite warfare concept and the way that that we structured those battle groups to operate at sea. So I'll pause there for a second and for anything that you might want to add.
Yeah, I'm going to have very little to add as someone who was born in 1980, and hopefully that doesn't make you or any of the listeners feel particularly old or young. How did that carrier battle group of the Cold War then morph into the carrier strike group of today? And then what are the approximate reasons for that transformation?
Yeah, so I think, I think there's a couple of them, right? As the Cold War wrapped up and we started to make some of those decisions to, peel away that 600 ship Navy down to what it is, or what it kind of morphed into when I first came to sea in 1995. I think you kind of saw some of the relics of what that structure was. So for instance, in 1995, when I made my first cruise with the America, I think you saw that, what was left over was, we sailed with the CGN, the USS South Carolina. We had the top of the line Ticonderoga class cruiser at that point as well. But, I think I think what ended up happening is, you know, you kind of had that middle phase there where, you know, you had American battle groups. And then I think what ended up happening was, you know, this whole idea of contesting sea control sort of becomes a thing of the past as the, you know, the Soviet Navy kind of goes away. In fact, on that America battle group cruise, one of the marquee events that we did was a passing exercise with the Admiral Kuznetsov battle group. You know, there was a Nastroshemi class, or the Nastroshemi came out, the Pilki, a Russian frigate, and Kuznetsov, and then there was a picture on the bridge wing of all of us standing there with Kuznetsov, you know, and, you know, in the background, had Russian officers on board the ship. We were doing dip tacks with them. It was just crazy. So, you know, once that all sort of evaporates, you know, you start to think about how you employ those forces differently. And by the time I went back to see as a department head, you know, the name of the game was, you know, how long can you stay in the Northern Arabian Gulf and steam around CVOA-4 and provide sorties to support what was going on in Iraq. So, you know, when you break that structure up and you start thinking about how you need to employ it, you know, changes occur. You know, when sea control is not your primary mission, you have a little bit more flexibility in how you organize and structure those forces. I don't necessarily know if we did it by design, but, you know, we're looking for opportunities to advance or allow or provide, you know, what we had put to sea to better use in the GWAT timeframe. So, that's kind of how I think we got there. There are probably others out there with, you know, with a much better perspective on it, but just my own experience would suggest that was probably part of, you know, that's how it just kind of came about. So I'll pause there.
Well, I'm at least going to advance the position, and you can tell me whether you know concur, don't concur, that some of it is probably budgetary as well. You mentioned the diversity of platforms, and I always refer to like the opening aviation sequence at the beginning of the movie, the Final Countdown, with Kirk Douglas and USS Nimitz traveling back in time. But that first about 2 minutes, you see like six different or seven different type of, you know, jet powered aircraft launching off of the USS Nimitz. Whereas, you know, for a time there, everything that flew off the deck of an American carrier looked like some variant of an F-18. And then you talked about the diversity of the surface escort force that sailed with the America, from the Ticonderoga to Knox class frigates, Perry class frigates, the nuclear powered cruiser. All that looks like an Arleigh Burke today for the most part, as we start to decommission the cruisers to recapitalize the surface fleet. So I don't know if you had any thoughts on that.
No, I think, you know, you're probably, well, yeah, I mean, that's a great way to characterize it. I mean, I guess in some ways budgets drive strategy, and strategy, you know, essentially drives, you know, how we operationally employ in the TTPs, right? But having that homogeneity, at least of platform type, and you know, from a procurement standpoint, probably makes things easier. I'm not an AP, so I won't pretend to think that that's an accurate statement, but, you know, certainly, right? That diversity or that homogeneity of today's stuff portends a lot of really interesting things if you wanted to walk that dog. And it, you know, I kind of touched a little bit on that in this particular piece, but, you know, if you... You know, if you look at the strike group that puts to sea in 2030, right, that's pretty much an all Burke class, strike group when you think about it, right?
We may get a constellation frigate or two in there, hopefully.
Yeah, you could. Yeah, I mean, I'm not quite sure on the time frame of that, right? Whether we'll have constellation class frigates in those strike groups at that point, but. Yeah, I mean, you know, granted, there's probably a massive difference between 2As and 3s in some ways, right? But, you know, it kind of does beg the question of, the structure of what that fighting element looks like, how you're going to command and control it, and to what degree is the staff involved in that, and what does that staff structure look like? And that's kind of how I kind of stumbled upon, well, I didn't really stumble upon, how I really kind of started to think about how we would do this, or what those elements of employment would look like, right?
How is the threat from China today different from the Soviet threat?
I'm not sure that, I don't know if I could adequately describe that. But I mean, from my perspective, right? I'm sure that there's a bunch of WTIs out there that could probably better have that dialogue with you. But I think how you could at least describe it, at least generally, I think that there's still a lot of anti-ship cruise missile stuff that that's going to be required to be contended with. There's still going to be some sort of ASW threat. I mean, I think the Chinese are going to, continue to put to sea some really, for lack of a better term, sexy stuff that will probably look a lot like what the Soviet Navy put to sea. But I think that the big challenge will be the speed at which those threats can present, the complexity of the different spectral environments that that we'll end up operating in those instances. So, that's a really interesting question in terms of the degree of that threat. And then, of course, how the PLAN would actually employ that, employ that high-end combat force to achieve or apply it to some sort of an operational art objective. But I run the risk of becoming, I run the risk of getting out of my depth in that particular instance. I'm sure there's a lot more smarter people in there in terms of how they would actually employ some of that stuff. But, I think it's alike in some instances and different in others, so.
What's the current construct for the DESRON, and why do you think it's too limited for the potential threat?
Yeah, so as I looked at the problem set, right, and I've written a lot about this topic of strike groups going to sea and fighting, right? I think there's five or six articles on SIMSEC, and the first time we talked about planning methodologies, right? And, if you look at the current DESRON structure, I probably described it in that first interview, as two big missions and a staff structure that, wasn't optimized for either of them, right? And then, when you start to peel back how that staff is actually manned, right? And you find out that, it's not really staff to be a battle staff, and it's not really staff to be an ISIC staff. It ends up reaching a number around the 35 to 40 pack standpoint at some point, at some level, and you structure that into watch teams and the like. But it wasn't designed with the end state in mind, right? You essentially take what you've got and you do the best with with what you've got, and you figure it out, right? And DESRON staffs have been figuring it out for 10 years. The way I would describe it is, it was built, at least from a tactical perspective, to be embarked on the carrier. It was built to be able to satisfy a three-section watch over a bunch of Navy tactical tasks that, if you look them up in the ROTPO, are pretty standard, as you would suspect. But and then you have some niche capabilities in there that, the ability to embark, naval oceanographic and assessment team, a NOAA team, to come on board and help you with your ASW prosecutions. But if you look at it, my contention in the article is that that's just, it's not the right mix, and it's probably not robust enough if you want to employ that thing in a different way. So, it, you know, to me, the fight of the future is going to be more distributed, and to be able to be successful in that fight, you're going to have to be able to break down your combat power into smaller bites, and you're going to need command elements to be able to go out and support those operations. And you know, the defense of the carrier would be one of many things, almost like an enabler, right, to whatever that degree of sea control is that you're trying to establish, and over, you know, how broad of an area is that going to be, how much dispersion is that, who does that require. So you know, you have to look at that destroyer squadron staff, and you have to look at it in a way, I think, that, you know, the current construct doesn't allow you the flexibility to use it. So
before we discuss the concept itself, what assumptions are baked into your proposal?
Yeah, the assumptions, well, I think I kind of covered a couple of them. The assumption on the front end is that the carrier strike group as a unit of issue will be employed after, or in, you know, when sea control is at least established to a point where, you know, you've got a little bit more freedom of maneuver. So that's, you know, assumption number one. Assumption number two is that that degree of sea control in time and space, you know, will require that you have smaller elements of combat power, and those smaller elements will need to have some sort of, you know, task force command structure over it that can, you know, link into higher headquarters battle rhythms and operate a little bit more autonomously. And then the final assumption, and I'm not sure I quite developed this in the article per se, my sense is that that command and control structure will need to have a bit of persistence. And by persistence, I mean that it's you're going to have to last into the second and third iterations of the engagement, right? You know, we're gonna parry back and forth a few times, you know, as we, you know, seek to break into these different areas of where we're going to establish sea control. So, you know, that command and control structure is going to have to be robust enough to have some staying power.
So you mentioned the staffing piece earlier, and that the DESRON construct was, as it exists, is not really appropriately staffed, in your opinion, to support either its ISIC oversight duties or its warfighting duties. How would you update your concept from a personnel perspective?
Yeah, I think put a decent table inside the article that would kind of break through that. So when we, you know, and I had some help, you know, a couple of my staff officers that I worked with when I was in command of DESRON 26, Jason Lancaster, a contributor to SimSec, and Chris Ragsdale, he's heading out to BDXO on, I think, one of the new LPDs, I believe. But we talked a lot about how we would do that differently. And I think the biggest difference in the way that we structured that DESRON staff model was the amount and type of watchstanders, right? So I think we wrote that up from a six section perspective. If you were on the carrier, that would be ridiculously robust. You know, I think we probably ran a four section watch bill when we were on deployment. So what you were able to do with that six sections of watch standards, and that would include staff TAOs and other station operators, at six sections, you have flexibility. You know, that's two terms of three, or that's, you know, three teams of two. And you know, you could farm those things out. So, you know, and if you wanted to do port and starboard for a short amount of time, you know, we could carve out that watch stand and cadre and have it in three different places. You know, if that's what the mission dictated. You know, and similarly, when you take that up one more level, the subject matter expertise that you would have from a COPS and FOPS perspective in terms of, you know, of planners and operators, for lack of a better term, would allow you to, you know, have some flexibility there as well. You know, shave off a couple of planners or shave off a couple of subject matter experts and get them out with, you know, one of those three teams or two teams, depending on how you have them sliced up. So, you know, there was a fair amount of 1110s in there that were, you know, TAO level kind of folks, department head level guys, and then some proven second, third, tour division officers that had some warfighting chops there as well to kind of help provide that level of flexibility. And then when you went up from one level from there, you kind of had the command deck. And I think the biggest difference in the command deck was that the whole notion of a fleet up model with the Commodore and the deputy, you know, kind of go back to the old way of looking at it, which was a Commodore and then a chief staff officer. And that chief staff officer was typically post-XO, pre-command. So you have an opportunity there to bring a different flavor of person in there. But the other thing that I would say there that I kind of mentioned in the bit too was the level of qualification of those folks, right? So, you know, at the officer level, you know, getting ASWA, SUW, WTIs on board that team, huge. Having some flavor of an IWTI amongst the, you know, information professional 1800 series officers, you know, in that mix would be super helpful. And then at that command level, having, you know, maritime advanced warfighting school graduates in that cadre, you know, helps have, you know, helps bring that a higher level of expertise, at least in the principles of the operational art, and, you know, having those commanders having, you know, been proven in those environments, right? I think just sets you up to have a more robust understanding of how, you know, those, you know, numerous units of issue inside that particular squadron section could be employed, and the staff experience to be able to lead in those environments. So it is much different than the way you would look at it now. A lot more first class petty officers and different rates to be able to support a watch bill, versus, you know, a couple of first classes here, you know, a couple of chiefs there. We tried to focus it a lot more on experience and expertise at the right level. I think the number ended up to be about 45 to 50, which is, just minorly larger than what ends up getting put to sea in a strike group staff or in a desert run staff that employs on a carrier now. I think I had 40-ish when I deployed. So, I mean, the number isn't that much different, but the type and level of experience is. That's something that would need to be managed over time.
Yeah, I think you're talking about a fit versus a fill type argument there.
Absolutely. 100%.
What sort of limitations do you see on implementing what you're describing? I'll give you an example of one that came up as I read through. You're calling for an 06 with a WTI background, but we're probably 10 plus years away from having one of those in the Navy. As far as I know, that WTI is a very young program, at least in the surface Navy. It's an awesome program. I love every WTI I've interacted with, and like the level of knowledge and the enthusiasm that they have for their subject matter. Those are all junior folks. I think the most senior one I've met is a brand new 04. So,
yeah, they're actually, you know, it, I'm calling for an 06 Moz graduate, which I would say are almost as unique as the WTI that they're speaking of right now. Yeah, absolutely. There's that's going to take a minute to develop, right? And I think, yeah, I think the Smittic guys would be salivating at the mouth to have one more demand signal placed upon it to be able to provide at that level. I'm sure that it's not necessarily a quality thing that they're looking for. So there's a quality cut there, and the WTIs in the IW community are even more more hard to come by. But yeah, so I mean, I think you're going to have all kinds of those arguments, right? You know, I think there were 6, 7, 8, STG1s and OS1s on a staff. Just going out and setting that demand signal and then applying that to, do you want your STG1s on ships or do you want them on a staff? Do you want your OS1s on ships or do you want them on a staff? I mean, I think we're in a kind of a zero sum game mentality on this. I think you have to make some choices. You're clearly gonna take a minute for WTIs to flow through the system, and you're gonna have more and more of them as time progresses. Yeah, so I kind of see this. I think I wrote it in there. This is a fit up problem, but you don't have to eat the apple all at in one bite, right? And maybe it's fill for a few years as you get to the fit goal, right? The point is that you'll give these folks focused training, almost career path like in some ways, and understand that training somebody to be a staff watch officer or training somebody to be a staff planner or bringing somebody with that kind of subject matter expertise is different than just pulling having a sailor roll off of sea duty on a ship and just automatically assume that they're going to be a good fit in that staff environment. Certainly doing better than we had in the past, and the level of expertise that I had on my team was probably better than they had 5 years ago, but I think we can do even better than that. I kind of set a pretty high bar there as I was describing that organization. But if you're going to employ it in the manners that I suggest, I think you need that level of expertise.
Yeah, and I guess when I say limitation, in particular with the WTI stuff, I mean, that's really a function of where we are in our particular timeline here, right? So, yeah, we don't have O6s with a WTI background in the surface fleet right now, but in 8 to 10 years, we're going to have more than a couple of them. There's going to be a bunch of them running around. Is that very first crop who went through as like senior lieutenants, junior lieutenant commander types, age into that role. And they were already identified for WTI because they were outstanding performers. If you extrapolate the outstanding performance, well, there's a very good chance that they're going to advance through 05 command, become 06s, and be out there and available to command the formations that you're talking about. So what appears to be a limitation today is not necessarily a limitation moving forward. It's just a matter of like, okay, well, we got to wait until we get that point in the timeline.
You could have your first, Commodore guy with those bona fides, right? Leading a organization like that, probably cover down on Desron 15 tomorrow and lead that organization to victory, or Desron 60 out in Rota. Which from what I understand and feedback since I've done the article, are the closest organizations out there right now structured to operate, trained to operate and operate in this, task force commander kind of approach to a Desron staff. So, could be there in 3 years, right? So, we've got some of the pieces. I think it's just, there's an opportunity there. We just have to put these folks in the right space, and then give them some tools, and they'll lead it quite well.
So what would the optimized fleet response plan in its various phases, basic, intermediate, advanced, maintenance, et cetera, look like for this new Desron staff?
Yeah. So, I spent a little bit of time talking about how you would do that. Right. I think it all kind of starts in sustainment. That group of squadron guys that and gals that that made that last deployment. You know, they're going to start to matriculate folks that were, you know, coming up on PRDs, et cetera. And I think what I tried to do as I described that was, is that, you know, sustainment begins the, kind of begins the tailored training for the next amount of stuff that, you know, that particular staff is going to need to take on. So, you know, I talked about in the article, you know, about setting a, you know, setting up a, you know, kind of a bespoke and curated training plan led by the WTIs on staff. You know, the guy that was the cops officer, you know, cops ops or cops officer fleets up to be the FOPs, and, you know, he kind of becomes the senior, you know, he or she becomes the senior warfighter on the team and kind of, you know, sets the, you know, sets the structure and the agenda. And then I think, you know, once that, you know, maintenance phase, you spend a whole bunch of time kind of going through that training plan, doing staff rides, going and visiting different different enabler type organizations, you know, doing, you know, spending some time at TAC Training Group Land, TAC Training Group PAC, where I'm, you're getting, you're going through basic level simulations and things like that. And then I think in the basic phase, you know, that staff is really starting to kind of congeal. My sense would be that you would want to try to have as many of the folks that you would be going on your next employment with, you know, sort of, you know, filled out and on that team so that, you know, training can begin in earnest. So, you know, in the current construct, you know, I didn't get all of my people, you know, just like everybody else until, you know, right as we were getting ready to go for group sale and SWAT. You know, try to get as many of those new teammates on board and, you know, kind of fleshed out and, you know, everybody understands what their role is, and then, you know, kind of go through different tailored training bits for watchstanders, for planners, for the specialty officers that were, you know, listed there in the table, like the NFO from the PA community, the Romeo guy, the 1120, the Intel, you know, the Intel officer, and, you know, leading some, you know, specific training and development for those particular teams in those environments. And then, you know, with the goal of, you know, essentially, you know, being ready to, you know, embark that carrier or embark the destroyer of choice for group sail and SWAT, and being able to, you know, run an effective watch team plan, you know, at the level of complexity necessary to execute group sail and SWAT. I think that, you know, a big difference we would have to sort out as well would be, how do you certify that bigger staff and its subordinate or in its different states? Yeah, I think there would have to be some sort of syllabus written to be able to do that. You could clearly do it, you know, in a TAC Training Group Land environment, but, you know, as anybody knows, as soon as you embark the staff on your ship, it changes a lot of things. And there's a bunch of very detailed things that have to take place to, you know, essentially embark a DDG as part of the DESRON staff. So, you know, doing that physically, I think, is important. So you would have to work that into the Comp2X syllabus as well, to be able to, you know, to certify that team could operate in its, you know, as a sum of its parts, so to speak. So, yeah, I think, you know, again, not out of the realm of the possible. It would just take some smart lieutenants and lieutenant commanders to sit down and figure out how all that would all work. And, you know, you could have it and run at least piecemeal, I would say, a lot sooner rather than later, if you put the right level of effort to it with the right leadership support.
Well, I'm sorry, that's all that we have time for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Captain Bill Shafley. Sir, where can we find you online, and what are you working on next?
What am I working on next? You know, I am on LinkedIn. One got quite a bit of bounce stocks thanks to John Cordell, you know, the old surf plant captain that many of us know. So I'm on LinkedIn, and I think I may try to do one more article, and, you know, in this series, and kind of wrap it up. And I think that one, as I'm kind of considering it, is there's a human capital component to all of this that that I think we may be missing. And I'll probably focus it on the officer side of the continuum. The prototypical, how do we career path, to the point where we could get, commander with that type of well-developed and honed mind to be a commander at this level, right? And if you think through that for a second, that just has amazingly interesting second and third order effects for future strike group commanders and their warfighting acumen. So got some water to go over to the dam on that one. But I think that's kind of the final piece to this train of thought that I've been messing with here over the last 2 or 3 years. So thanks for having me this afternoon, Jared. I appreciate your time.
Well, thanks again for joining us, sir. To the listeners, thank you for tuning in. We'll see you next time.